Today's Teisho will be on Case 33 in the Book of Serenity. Case 33 is entitled Sansheng's Golden Fish. Introduction: meeting the strong, be weak. Meeting the soft, be hard. If both are hard and hit each other, there will surely be one damaged. But tell me, how do you interchange? Case. Sansheng asked Zhuifeng, "The golden fish that's passed through the net, what does it use for food?" Zhuifeng said, "When you come out of the net, I'll tell you." Sansheng said, "The teacher of 1,500 people, yet you don't even know a saying." Zhuifeng said, "My tasks as abbot are many." Verse. When first ascending the tiers of waves, cloud and thunder accompany, leaping up magnificently, look at the great function. With a tail burnt, he clearly crosses the gate of Yu. The beautiful fish won't agree to be sunk in a pickle jar. An old, mature man does not startle the crowd. Someone used to facing a great adversary has no fear from the start. Floating, just as light as 5 ounces, massive, heavier than even 1,000 tons. Sansheng's exalted fame over the four seas. Who was his peer? Zhuifeng stands alone. The 8 winds blowing do not move him. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning on this beautiful, hot summer day. There's something, I think, quite special about coming in here, sitting still, entering samadhi in the dark, and really going deeply into concentration. You sit down on the cushion, the room is dark, you watch your breath, maybe you're struggling with your body. Maybe it's not easy to work with this morning. Maybe you're struggling with your mind. Maybe your thoughts are distracting you. There's things at your work, things with your family. Your mind is going around and around, and you keep trying to bring it back to the breath. Maybe your back hurts. Maybe you're tired, and you fall asleep on the cushion. You keep struggling to get back to the breath. And maybe a little bit, you began to settle into the breath. You began to be less tired, working with the dantian, breathing through the hara, the abdominal breathing. You begin to feel stirring of energy. Mind becomes still. Mental focus increases. Maybe you enter this place at the end of the breath, which is very still, very really motionless. And the bell rings after the second sit, and we get up and we walk outside into the summer day. And when you feel the heat on your feet, it's really hot. When you step into the shade, it's really cool, it's really beautiful. There's something quite special about that. When we enter this state of deep samadhi, deep concentration, and then we experience the world of form, it comes alive in a special way. Basically, we go through our lives often with these barriers between us and the world. Those barriers are largely our own making. So, I myself am sometimes so caught up in my thoughts that I don't even pay attention to what's going on around me. You know, I see this all the time where people, you know, are so caught up in sort of like their internal movie, their mental movie, that they don't really see what's going on. And it's as though there's a kind of barrier, film, between us and the world. Just this, we're constantly, you know, human beings secrete thoughts the way an oyster secretes its shell, you know? Oysters actually secrete shells to protect themselves. And they secrete quite beautiful shells sometimes, but it's really a defensive mechanism. And without the shells, they would die, it's true. But, you know, eventually they become very closed up in their shells, and humans are like this too. You know, fear is a powerful motivator. And we secrete thoughts and symbols and abstract ideas. We secrete all kinds of things, mental constructs. And, you know, as we go through our daily life, it can really prevent us from being fully in the moment. So one of the great beauties of Zen practice, of Zen meditation, is that we can pull away that film. Sometimes it takes a fair amount of work, but we can pull away that film, and when we experience the world, we're not so distracted by our inner dramas. And it has this incredible liveliness and immediacy. You know, in some cultures, people actually think of the natural world as alive and magical, like magical, you know, alive. You know, we now, in our time, in the 21st century, where we're very much enthralled by technology, you know, we think of that mindset as rather primitive, you know. But actually, it's quite accurate. You know, when we aren't distracted by our thoughts and caught up in these terrible inner dramas, right, you know, when we can be fully in the moment, everything seems like part of our own life. Everything seems intensely alive, even like sidewalk, heat. Everything is alive, you know. This is a very important teaching of Zen. When we're really practiced at being in deep samadhi, we go through this process of breaking through the veil, pushing aside the veil and coming into the light, you know, coming into the shade, coming into the heat. And it's everything is alive, you know. So today, very special day, we can't always go outside because there's construction or there's band practice. But today we're lucky that nobody was out there and we could actually just walk around the fountain. So this koan is involves a golden fish. Sun Sheng asked Zhuifeng, "The golden fish is out of the net, has passed through the net. What does it use for food?" You know, I think we all feel sometimes that we're trapped in the net. You know, this image of a net is so powerful, right? Because, you know, we all get trapped. We all feel like a wild fish in the sea that's caught in a net sometimes. I'm sure if you haven't had that experience yet, you might have it, you know. A friend of mine was involved in a political conflict at his workplace, and he really lost the political conflict, and he had to step down from his position. You know, basically he was no longer able to do many of the things that he used to do as a professor. He had many responsibilities and was very active and very creative. And, you know, even in my world, the world of, like, academic world, there's conflicts and politics and so on. And he really lost his political struggle. And he was really, like, had to step down from his position. And this is somebody who loves being active and doing things. So he's been looking for jobs at other universities. And he's been writing letters to other universities trying to get somebody to hire him because he has all these talents, all these abilities that he can't use right now. And he's really eaten up by this. You know, he's really troubled by this because he wants to be creative and useful. And he can't be right now. And so he's sitting basically in his house writing articles, which is not what he really wants to do. And he feels totally trapped, totally trapped. I have another friend who is a male nurse. He's a nurse in a hospital. And his specialty is like emergency work. So if you have an emergency, usually in the ambulance, there's one like emergency nurse. They're highly trained. This person used to be a teacher. He was a high school teacher for 25 years, and then he started a new career as a nurse. And he's very much into helping others. So anyway, he's a nurse, and he loves his job, but his supervisor does not like him. Does not like him at all. And I know him. I think he's a great guy. So I can only imagine that the supervisor is not a nice person. But who knows? You know, the relationships are so complex. Maybe he's nice to me, but he's not nice to his supervisor. I don't know. But the thing is, he feels trapped. He feels trapped. He's taking courses at night now in IT, in computer development. So maybe he can do something with computers and transfer out. But you know, also in our personal lives, you know, when I was in college, I was in a relationship with a person. And we never got along, but we couldn't separate. You know, it was like this went on for 2 years. I was thinking about this woman this morning, actually. I hadn't thought about her in many years. But, you know, we became friends when we first got to my university, and we had a relationship for a couple of years, and it was always a rocky relationship. And eventually it made us both very unhappy, but we had never had relationships with anybody else, so we didn't want to break it off. So we were trapped, really being trapped. When my parents, at that same time, my parents were getting a divorce when I was in college, and I would come home and the house was so unhappy. Everybody was unhappy. Even the dog was unhappy. You know, so I would leave college and I was unhappy with my girlfriend, and I would go home and my home was like this very unhappy place. So I used to go and work, I had a job, but in the evening sometimes I'd just go to the library so I wouldn't have to be at home. You know, so I felt trapped, yeah? Trapped, the net, you know, let me out of this net. So this koan is very human, very human story of being trapped. You know, I could just go on and on about all the ways it's possible to feel trapped in life. And, you know, in many ways, many people feel trapped right now. It's a common human experience, and especially now, you know. Right now, our economy's not doing well. Lots of young people are looking for jobs. They're getting out of college deeply in debt. I have another friend who's highly skilled, very well educated. I mean, he's much better educated than I am. And he's out of a job. His corporation laid off 1,500 workers. And the top people, these are like scientists, you know. So trapped. Anyway, you know, this is a difficult situation to be in, because when we feel trapped, our world gets smaller and smaller. And just when it should get bigger and bigger, what we do is we tend to withdraw. You know, when we're frightened or when we feel threatened in life, we contract. It's like that, we close the shell, you know. You know, when things are going well in our life, it's easy to be expansive. It's easy to be expansive. So you know, sometimes things are just going well, right? You go to work and your boss says, "God, you're so good." And you go home and your partner says, "You know, what a handsome man you are, you know, or what a beautiful woman you are, you know." And you call up your mother and you have a lovely conversation, or you know, maybe you're into you go to a race, you go to the marathon, and you come in the top 10%, you know, something like that. You know, it's easy if you just come in at the front of the pack at the marathon. You know, after the marathon's over, it's easy to walk around and go, "Hi, I'm Jim. How's it going? This is what a day, huh?" You know, you feel confident, you feel open, you know, you feel like the world is your friend. You know, but if you come in the last, you know, I myself have run several marathons. I am quite a good runner, but I'm not a fast runner, so I always come in towards the end. But at least I make it, at least I finish, you know. But some people that really bothers them. You know, if I have done several half marathons and several marathons. And the first time I did this marathon in Seattle, I thought I couldn't make it. I hit that place where you just think you're going to collapse. So, you know, I kind of cheated. I sort of rested, and then I went on. So I was like at the very end of this. It didn't bother me at all. I was so proud to have finished. But I have friends who are like very competitive, and if they don't make a certain sector of the, you know, when they don't, they want to come in the first 10% or something, or they feel like they've failed. So you know, probably if they didn't come in the first 10, you know, the top 10%, the first 10%, they wouldn't be so open. You know, they might feel ashamed. You know, so when they look at other people, they don't go, "Hi, I'm Jim." They think, "Oh my God," you know, they realize I'm a loser, you know. If you've just lost your job, you might not feel very expansive when you're out on the street. You might not walk up to somebody, you know, when you've just gotten a raise, you walk outside and it's like, hey, you know, you get, maybe you're in New York, you have to take a cab, you give the guy a $5 tip, you know, enjoy the day, buddy, you know, thanks, you know, you feel like a king, right? So when things are going well, we feel open and expansive. When things go badly, we begin to feel frightened, like we're losing control or we have no control. And this makes us close up. It makes us, fear makes us close up. You know, you might be familiar with a person named Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti used to say, "Fear kills the mind." And that's so true. You know, fear makes us unintelligent, and we close up. It closes our hearts. You know, we're not expansive and generous. We become fearful, and we feel beleaguered. Right. So this whole issue of the net is really important. You know, life deals us these events that cause us to close up. When we're trapped in the net, you know, we sort of like wind ourselves more deeply into the net, like a fish trying to get free. You get more and more caught, you know. So anyway, I think we've all been to this place. For a minute, I'd like to change a direction just a little bit. I'll come back to the fish caught in the net. You know, the day before yesterday, or was it yesterday? Yesterday. We celebrated, I guess it was Thursday. We celebrated the 4th of July, which is Independence Day. The reason I'm confused about this is that if you know New Jersey, all towns in New Jersey don't have their fireworks the same day. So South Plainfield had their fireworks on Wednesday. Plainfield also had their fireworks on Wednesday. basically a Thursday night were fireworks, but not in Plainfield where I live. That it was over in Cranford, and some other town had it last night. I was driving home, so you get a little confused. But the point is, the 4th of July is Independence Day. And most people know that, although not everybody. A few years ago, one of my radio shows that I like to listen to, a person went out into the street with a microphone and he asked people what the 4th of July was. And very few people actually knew. People said, that was when we fought a war with France, wasn't it? You know, no. Nevertheless, most people understand that 4th of July is Independence Day. And we put a big premium on independence. This is so important for us, right? When you grow up, you know, your parents might tell you, you need to be independent. We want you to be independent. You know? And people really put a big premium on independence. Independence. You know, we're celebrating our freedom, our independence. This is like a major theme in our cultural life, is to be independent, to take care of yourself. Don't lean on others. Depend actually means like to actually like lean on or hang off of, you know. So if you're independent, you're not leaning on others. You're doing it all yourself, you know. And we kind of admire that, right? Somebody who, you know, just basically solves the problem himself and so on. And there's something to that, you know. I myself, you know, I've tried to be independent myself. When I left college, you know, I didn't ask my, you know, I went off on my own. I found a job. I was really proud of myself, you know. I was independent. I didn't call up my dad and say, quick, you know, send me some money. I sometimes I was broke, but I didn't do it because I wanted to be independent. And there's something good about that, right? Be taking care of yourself, being responsible, and so on. That's good. But, you know, I think we overdo it in our culture, you know, because my feeling is that we put too much importance on independence. You know, my feeling is that the number one problem for people in our society is that they don't feel connected enough. You know, they don't. I think lots of people feel isolated. Or isolated, yeah, from other people, and a fair number of people feel very lonely, as a matter of fact, you know. And we never feel more isolated, I think, than when things go wrong in our lives, you know. Often that's when we become very, very isolated. So I think we put too much emphasis on being independent. And not enough emphasis on being interdependent. Interdependent. I was reading in the, I don't know if you read the Huffington Post, but I read the Huffington Post quite almost every day. And there was an article in there about how all of these CEOs do meditation. So they had these big shots in the world of high tech and finance, and it turns out these people, some of whom I didn't really know by name, but they're big shots in like Silicon Valley, and it turns out they all meditate. And Arianna Huffington, the editor of the Huffington Post, also meditates. So they looked at this person, and he meditates, and this woman, there was a Indian businesswoman whose last name is Warrior, and I didn't know that was an Indian name, Warrior, but she's from, you know, South Asia, and she's a CEO of some major corporation, and all these CEOs meditate, and. I mean, I'm very glad they meditate, but I kind of thought, well, you know, what? They're probably not that stressed. My feeling was, okay, they're very successful and they meditate. You know, great. Then I read this other article in the paper, and it's just coming out now. It was in the New York Times last night. And this person said, you know, everybody's talking about how wonderful meditation is, and how all these CEOs do meditation, and isn't that great? And he said, but you know, we're not really paying attention to what meditation is really all about, which is not becoming successful and rich. Meditation is really about something else. And they did a study, and it's in the New York Times today. I'm not going to get it quite right. But the point is, when people these are psychologists, social psychologists, so they have people do something, and then there's some little, they might have to take a test, and then during the test, somebody will come in and ask if they can have their chair or something, you know, can I sit in your chair, or can I sit next to you, and anyway, I think that the experiment was like, these people are being asked to take a test, but there's four chairs and five people. So somebody will ask one of the experimental subjects, listen, could I sit in your chair? Basically, the point is that in the control group, these are people who don't meditate, when someone asks the subject for a chair, only 15% of people ordinarily say yes. Okay, so you know, if you see a seat on the train coming out of New York and there's a vacant seat and somebody says, "Can I have that seat?" Normally, only 15% of people, according to this experiment, would say yes. But the interesting thing is, they also had people go through meditation, and then there was this test where people asked for the seat. And after doing meditation, 50% said, yes, you can have the chair. So this guy's claim is that meditation makes people more compassionate. And the article is so beautiful because it says, really, you know, meditation isn't about becoming a success. Although that is nice, you know, it's really about being generous and compassionate. And I just felt like cheering when I read this article because, you know, this, okay, all these CEOs do meditation. I'm very happy for them, you know. But it's really not about success. It's really about something else, you know. When somebody asked these meditators for a chair, 50% of them said yes. And I would like to think that if they continued to meditate, they'd all say yes. But at least half of them did, when the normal people would, about 15%. So there's something about meditation which counteracts, I think, this tendency to withdraw into ourselves and to begin to see the world in terms of me and the others. You know, me, world. World and me. You know, and sometimes this is a conflict. When I was growing up, one of the most famous philosophers was a French thinker whose name was Jean-Paul Sartre, if you want to sound French about it. And Monsieur Sartre used to actually say, he was famous for saying, l'enfer est l'autre, which means hell is others. Isn't that amazing? He was famous for that. Everybody read his books. When I was in college, hell is others. Everybody would go, oh yes, hell is others. You know. Well, that's a hell of a philosophy, don't you think? You know, maybe he's describing what it was like to go through World War II. He was in France when it was occupied by the Germans. The French people themselves collaborated often with the Nazis. They turned in each other, and so the French came out of the war with this very negative view of each other, right? And Sartre had this whole philosophy about how basically we're always in a conflict with others, see? And I think sometimes our culture encourages that mindset where, you know, when you feel threatened or frightened, you begin to look at other people as competitors or rivals for happiness. It's like happiness becomes a scarce commodity. And we begin to look at other people as our competitors. There's only so much food on the table. Either I'm going to eat it or you're going to eat it. and I haven't gotten enough to eat, so I'm going to have to put your considerations. I'm not going to give you the chair. You know, I need the chair, and I need the table, and I need all the food on the table. So we all behave this way. I find myself getting into this mindset too. But it actually makes the situation worse. It makes things worse, because there's no end to how closed up and frightened we can get. So, you know, one way to look at meditation is that it has this amazing property of opening us back up when we feel like we're trapped in the net. And, you know, you come to the sit, that you came to sit this morning, we sat for an hour, or we sat for 2.5 hours, and, you know, you begin to open up a little bit. It's like you come into the, you know, sometimes we start out sitting like a closed fist, you know? And after two sits, that closed fist becomes more like an open hand, you know? And this process, you repeat this process thousands of times if you do meditation for many years, and maybe you become a little bit more like an open hand in your everyday life. Being open is so hard when we're under assault, or when we're frightened, or when we're worried about the future. But when we're in that open state, so many wonderful things happen to us, in addition to what we can do to help others, you know. So you know, one way to think about Zen is that it's really all about counteracting this tendency we have to become fearful and frightened. You know, many years ago, I had the chance to meet a Zen teacher, very famous Zen teacher, who was staying with my teacher, Genki Roshi, in Seattle. At this time, I was the attendant for Genki Roshi, and I would get up every morning and go to sit at Kugeon, where he lived, which was up on this hill, this beautiful little mountain in South Seattle that we found. And we would have Zazen there, and no matter how cold it was, he would open up the windows. I would come in and sit, and the windows would be closed, and I would think, maybe he'll forget today. But he would never forget. You know, I would sit down, and then he'd remember to open the windows. He'd open them up, and it would be freezing cold in the Zendo. This is just, in Japan, that's how they sit. You know, no heater. So anyway, it would be like an hour and a half of being very cold, and then I would feel great. You know, the rest of my day was really good. So anyway, I would get there and cook breakfast. That was part of my job, to prepare make sure the meal was done well, and clean up, and then I had to go off to my teaching job. And I would, you know, get things like groceries for Genki Roshi and take care of his personal needs, or some of his personal needs. And he had a guest who was this Zen teacher, this Roshi from Japan, who was dying of cancer. And at this time, I was so anxious. I was really closed up. I mean, that's why I was doing Zen. You know, I was in graduate school, and I wasn't really sure I was cut out for graduate school. And I didn't know what else I was going to do. You know, if not graduate school, what? It just looked like a big... There was graduate school or what? And when I thought about the what, it was terrifying, right? You know, what will I do? You know, I'm an English major. I haven't been trained to work in a bank. I actually went to a bank once. I when I got out of college, I was looking around for jobs before I went to graduate school, and I went to a bank. And this old man interviewed me, and he looked at my CV, and I don't know why he interviewed me, except I guess he wanted to humiliate me. Because I sat down and he looked at my CV and he said, "What makes you think you can work in a bank?" And I didn't know what to say, so I didn't get the job. I don't know what he expected me to say. Maybe if I was interested in banking, I would have had a good answer, but I didn't. So I didn't get the job. And I had a number of experiences. I ran a restaurant. I did things like that. But when I was in graduate school, it seemed like it was my last chance, you know. just like this is my last chance. So I was not doing well in graduate school, but outside of graduate school, it looked really like worse, frightening. And you know, I would worry all the time. You know, if I would worry about the papers I was writing. If I got a good grade, I'd worry that the next paper wouldn't be as good. If I didn't get the grade I wanted, I'd worry that I was going to be thrown out of graduate school. If I had a good day in class and I said something intelligent, I'd worry about, you know, whether it was intelligent enough. You know, we can be frightened in so many different ways. So anyway, this Zen master was staying at Kugeon, Genki Roshi's place, and he was dying. He had cancer. He had come to see Genki. And I was so impressed by it. This was one of the most important events that happened to me in my life, meeting this guy. Because he was so delightful and calm. And he sat like a rock. Some days he was too sick to come down and sit with us. But he sat like a rock, and he was so alive. He was just like, and it did occur to me, you know, what am I so afraid of? You know, we're all going to die, you know. And this guy was so open. It was like he wasn't worried about failing. He wasn't worried about anything anymore. He was just 100% present. And I realized, you know, it's possible to live that way. I think it's what kept me practicing Zen. You know, it's possible not to be a closed fist all the time, but to be like an open hand. It takes a lot of work. People are not naturally open hand. You know, we have to do a lot, I would say we have to do a lot of Zazen or something like Zazen to really be awake, really be present. And open. So, but it really impressed me meeting this guy, you know. And something else happened to me that I think is really related to this koan. You know, we feel so trapped sometimes, and Zen is all about getting outside of that closed up self, which is so easy to get into, that frightened, closed-up self. And a lot of our culture encourages us to look at other people as our competitors or our rivals for happiness. And even in Zen, this can happen, you know? I've been at Zen centers where there are people who are really very proud of their ability to sit well or how many koans they've answered. You know, people have actually come up to me and said, well, how many koans have you done? You know, I don't know. How many are there? And actually, somebody will actually know. It's like, there's like 8,000 or something. Well, I haven't done 8,000. You know. But people can be competitive about Zen practice, too. You can meet people who actually want to sit better than everybody else in the room. So, you know, actually, I was a bit like that when I got started doing Zen practice. I saw Zen as a way of being successful. And I tried to sit longer than other people and sit better than other people. And I was doing koan training with Genki Roshi. And I would go into my private interview, Dokusan, with Genki, and I would give him my answers, and I could never seem to pass the breath perception koan. So he asked me to watch my breath and tell him what was happening, but I would always come in and try to impress him with my insight. You know. And this went on for several years. Everybody else in the Zen Center was passing koans. We would come home from sesshins, from our retreats, and people would say, oh, I passed another koan. I'd think, oh my God, I haven't passed a single koan. I'm going to be 90 years old and I'll still be working on my breath perception koan. So I was very competitive. I saw others as my rivals for enlightenment, you know. So anyway, you know, finally, Roshi asked me to be the tenzo, which means cook. So I had to give up 6 months of my Zen training and just do food for the group, do all the cooking for the group, especially at the retreats, at the sesshins. And at the time, I really thought this was a disaster because I thought I was losing my chance to become, to do lots of Zen practice that would make me an exceptional Zen student. And so anyway, I grudgingly agreed to be the cook, and I cooked at a number of sesshins, three sesshins. And you know, the interesting thing was that when I gave up my desire to be excellent at Zen, and I decided I was just going to take care of everybody and feed them as well as I could, I really got into cooking. You know, I really found that cooking is a wonderful practice. You know, making food for other people is a wonderful practice. You know, in classical Zen temples, you know, the cook is actually often the most deeply enlightened person in the temple. Isn't that interesting? So basically, I didn't understand what it meant to cook for others, but when I was assigned to the job of cook, I began to worry about whether people were getting enough food, whether it was good, you know, and so on and so on. And I cooked for a number of sesshins, and I just threw myself into it. And every meal, I would just prepare to the best of my ability, and I'd sort of peek through the door and look, and I could see if people were eating. If they didn't eat their food, I was worried, like, why didn't they eat this? You know, taste it, too much salt, you know, and my practice became taking care of other people. And it was really a transformative aspect of my Zen practice. Because I wasn't trying to be better than other people, I was trying to take care of other people. And it really transformed my relationship to everybody in the group. You know, I have friends in the Zen group at Seattle that I've had for 30 years. I called them on the phone. We're still friends. Getting outside of my competitive mentality was so good for me. You know. And at the end of the third session, Genki Roshi called me in and he said, "Listen, you still haven't answered the breath koan, but I'm going to pass you anyway because you've been such a good cook." And he said, "This is the first time I've seen you do something that wasn't, you know, rather selfish." And he didn't mean to hurt my feelings. He was, I mean, I saw the self-evident truth of what he was saying. You know. So, you know, this Zen practice can seem rather self-centered. You know, we all come here, we sit down on the cushion, we go into samadhi. And it's possible to say this is kind of narcissistic even, but I don't think so at all. You know, Zen is all about getting outside of the boundaries of our fearful small self, opening up. And, you know, when you open up, you give your chair to somebody. When you're not frightened and fearful, you know, if somebody says, "Can I have this chair?" You say, "Sure, it's just a chair." Or, "I'm happy to see you happy." You know, that's really somebody who's been doing a lot of sitting. Your happiness makes me happy, you know. Your happiness is my happiness, see? That's the truth. So if we can be in that mindset a lot, we're in a good place, right? That's like Buddha mind. Your happiness is my happiness. Your joy is my highest joy, you know? Your freedom is my freedom. See, this is Interdependence Day. Interdependence Day. This koan is such a wonderful koan because, you know, we all feel trapped in the net. But if we can get outside of this fearful mind, this competitive mind, the net really changes. You know, this net, which seems so imprisoning, takes on a different character. One of the major Buddhist sutras is called the Flower Ornament Sutra. Flower Ornament Sutra. It's something like 1,700 pages long. It is. It's enormous. I haven't read it. You know, I've read small pieces of it. Reading the Flower Ornament Sutra is actually like doing zazen. Maybe you read a page a day, and you just read a page a day. And it's very profound, because it's reading it is like meditation. It's written to be a kind of meditation practice. But one of the things the Flower Ornament Sutra teaches is that this whole world is arising out of nothingness. And everything arises together out of nothingness. In fact, the nothingness and the somethingness also arise together. So this world just is like miraculously arising. And your life and my life are absolutely interdependent. You know, if you try to, you could do a little thought experiment, you know. What would I be like if my father was a different man? You know, then you realize that's impossible. You know, I wouldn't be here at all, right? Or what if my mother were not my mother, but some other mother? Maybe Jim's mother. You know, you wouldn't be you, right? I mean, basically, everything we are is constantly being created by our relationships with everything around us. And it, basically, it's all arising together. The word for this in Sanskrit is svayambhu. The universe is svayambhu, self-creating, self-creating. In Nepal, up on a mountain, there's a temple, which is the most famous, oldest Buddhist temple in Nepal. It's called Svayambhunath, which means a self-creating temple, or the temple of the self-creating. So basically, the Hua Yin, the Flower Ornament Sutra says, this world is like a net of diamonds. And at every intersection of the net, every intersection of the net, there's a diamond, and the diamond reflects all the other diamonds, right, to infinity. So if you visualize a net that's covered with these transparent diamonds, and each one is reflecting the other to infinity, this is what the universe is, according to the Hua Yin Sutra. And, you know, basically there's a great truth to this teaching. Right? I mean, the sutra is saying, don't get caught up in independence, in your isolated selfhood. Everything around you is part of yourself. You know, when you go into deep samadhi on the cushion and you get up and you walk outside, the whole world becomes your body. The whole world has this magical liveliness, which is not a fantasy. It's the way things really are. Ordinary consciousness is the fantasy, the fearful, closed-off consciousness. That's the fantasy. We encounter experiences in life that close us up. And the function of our beautiful Zazen practice is to open up again. And the net is transformed from this place, which is like a prison, to this, you know, every once in a while, we just turn around and say, I am so glad to be alive. I am so glad to be alive. It's like, thank you for my life. This beautiful moment. Last night, we did meditation in this room. And then I drove home, and I got out of my car. And it was just a beautiful evening. Humid, yes. Hot, yes. You know, but the trees on the street, there's a little breeze and they're blowing. You know, and you think, this moment is perfect. You know, if you're opened up, you just think, this moment is perfect. Thank you for my life. You know. So, you know, we all go through this again and again. You know, things knock us down. They hurt us. We close up. We sit down on the cushion. We open up. And you get to a place where you're really open and trusting again, and it's like, thank you for my life. And this is the rhythm of practice. This is what practice is all about, being able to open up, even in the midst of these things that hurt us. And it takes a continuous effort, if I may say so. You know, it doesn't have to be zazen, but something like zazen. Forces you out of your small self and brings you to this moment, you know, in this open state. Sanshong's golden fish. Sanshong asks Zhuifeng, the golden fish that's passed through the net, what does it use for food? Zhuifeng said, when you come out of the net, I'll tell you. Sanshong said, you're the teacher of 1,500 people, yet you don't even know a saying. You can't even answer my question. And Zhuifeng said, look, I'm busy. I have a lot on my mind. So that's like a little joke. Basically, Sanshong says that's a wonderful... In Zen, when you read these Zen stories, when one person insults the other, they're really paying him a compliment. So it would be like saying to Albert Einstein, you're not very sharp, are you? In other words, you're a genius, right? So Sanshong says, that's a great answer, but he says it in a Zen way, which is to say, you're the teacher of 1,500 people, and you still can't answer a simple question. And then Zhuifeng says, well, look, I have a lot on my plate. When first descending, the tears of waves, clouds, and thunder accompany, leaping up magnificently, look at the great function. With a burnt tail, he clearly crosses the gate of you. The beautiful fish won't agree to be sunk in a pickle jar. You know? There's a part of you that doesn't want to be sunk in a pickle jar. You want a big life. And I think that's why you came to do Zazen. An old, mature man does not startle the crowd. Someone used to facing a great adversary has no fear from the start. If you avoid challenges, you become more and more afraid of challenges. If you can stay open and you embrace challenges, even big challenges don't frighten you. Floating, floating, just as light as 5 ounces. Massive, massive, heavier even than 1,000 tons. Sanshong's exalted fame over the four seas. Who was his peer? Zhuifeng stands alone, the 8 winds blowing do not move him.